Okay, folks, we are at the witching hour, so I'm going to mute all. And as usual, you will be able to unmute yourself if you have any comment or question. Please feel free to do so and remute yourself afterwards to keep background noise to a minimum. And, Alan tonight has a throat problem, and you're gonna have to put up with me running through the slides tonight. Forgive me for my and anything that I do wrong. Consider me a rookie at this. So welcome all members and guests. If you are guests, we are happy to have guests join us at any time at any of the Ottawa PCs group meetings. If you want to join us, I have pasted it into the chat window where you can go to join the group. It's only $20 a year, and if you join before the end of March, you will actually get 2 years for the price of one. And so feel free to check out that if you're interested. I think we will have time tonight for the final 10. So if you have any burning questions or comments or shares or anything like that, you can throw them into the chat or unmute yourself after we go through the regular deck. And with that, I will start up the deck for tonight. Following on from our last meeting, the January meeting, which was really, really excellent on scams and so forth, Alan put together a couple of slides here on some of the scams that he's seen lately that might keep this forefront in your mind. And so he's been receiving daily emails purporting to be business related and requesting money from him. And so some examples are there. Client presentation, and please locate the attached signed invoice and so forth. And he points out that if you look at them a little bit carefully, you can see some red flags. And so first is that he didn't know Tia Chin, and he doesn't deal with anybody at that domain name of nepalj.com. The subject says that it's travel costs bill submission. And then in the body of the text, it says office supplies that were bought. So he's making a note to the scammer. They should make up their mind and ask for consistent things in their scams if they hope to get past the average person. And he pointed out that if you hover the mouse over the link, it actually goes out to, this is actually a really interesting one, adclick.g.doubleclick.net. And so that's really, really bizarre. That they would send you to a doubleclick.net, so that's an advertising agency's website, presumably. Doubleclick.net is their real domain name. And then he pointed out that in the newsletter, for the February newsletter, which just went out, there's an article in there by Bridget on our Fraud Watch page on our website. So a little bit of details about the sort of things that you can find on that. So if you are looking to avoid fraud, check out our Fraud Watch page. It has links to a lot of other resources and companies that give you additional information on how to avoid fraud. Oh, and Alan says he thinks that doubleclick.net is as an ad site is defunct. So who knows where that link will actually go to. Okay, Stuart. Stuart has a share here. Stuart, did you want to talk to this slide?
I can say a few words. It's pretty straightforward. This is a link to a tool I found by reading an article in one of my favorite newsletters, Tedium, for us bored folks. The guy was discussing counterfeit products in general, and then he's drilled in on processors and the problem that occurred some time ago, particularly with MacBooks, I think it was, and Mac PCs in general, and copycat stuff coming out of China. And over time, the reputable manufacturers, or at least the ones that call them such, decided to develop verification tools so people could make sure they were buying what they were actually buying. And lo and behold, he mentioned an Intel page that has a link to a tool to confirm that. Well, about a year ago, I bought this nifty little mini PC from China through Amazon. I thought, what bigger target could there be? A Chinese computer through Amazon that was half, for the specs, was half the going rate of what you could get in North America. I thought, it must be fake. So I went to the link here on the page and downloaded the tool and said, hey, check out this processor, please. And it took 5 minutes and it checked all kinds of things and said, yes, it is actually an i5 Roy Rogers 6-gun special. So yeah, I got what I paid for. And Intel said so too. Now, this won't work if you have a Ryzen processor in your PC. Just Intel. You'll have to go hunting to see what AMD has for their processors. And if you have a MediaTek processor, or, geez, if you have a hamster on a wheel spinning and running your computer, you'll have to go to the vet and make sure it really is a hamster. But this might be handy given the fact that in these economic times, more and more people are looking to save a buck and maybe buying things from sketchy sites, not just Amazon. And I should back up a bit and say, even not that it's a processor may be counterfeit or dishonestly placed in your machine, maybe they actually just sent you the wrong one. Maybe it's off by one tiny speck, or you've got an extra hamster on a wheel. Anyway, you can verify exactly what you've got and even the clock speed it's running at if you have an Intel product with this tool. And I think I've run out of things to say about that.
Okay, thanks, sir. Actually, I didn't think to do it, but I've got a laptop that is actually running an AMD processor. I wonder what it'll tell me if I try running the utility on it. I would be actually very curious if anybody runs this utility on their Intel-based box and gets a surprise that it's not what they were sold. I'd be really interested to find that out, so you might want to share that at a future Q&A if anybody has that information. Okay, this is a share from Alan on the history of ARM processors. And so there's actually two parts to this, and if anybody is interested, there's the part one, and Alan has pasted the URLs into the chat if you're interested in learning a little bit more about the history of ARM. I was going to actually watch this today and got carried away with a couple of other things, so I didn't get a chance to look at it yet, but I definitely will. Sounds very interesting. Okay, the main presentation tonight actually is going to take up a fair amount of time, I think, but I think it will be time well spent. So if you don't know, the Auto PC User Group actually has a member forum, and if you're looking to discuss computer-related topics with other people in the user group, no better place to do this. It's open for business 24/7, and you can pose questions, talk about anything that you want computer-related in the forum. So just some examples of some recent ones. I posted something that the Wi-Fi Alliance, they announced the certification of Wi-Fi 7, and Paul Thurrott had an article about it, and so I pasted a snippet from that along with the URL to the full article. Tom posted about a Shampoo Pro 17 backup being free. So this is through the shareware on sale. If you sign up for them, you'll get an email every day of some piece of software that you can get free of charge typically. I think it's always something that's 100% off for a limited period of time. And there may be some other restrictions. It might be a 1 year a subscription to a particular software that's as a service or whatever, or it might be lifetime subscription for a single PC or a specific version of their software or something like that. But if you're looking for a backup program, you might want to check that out. Sergerik posted about a question that he had. He was looking for the best way to protect a PDF file, other than just having a password protected. So he was looking for some very specific things, the ability to prevent editing or copying, so not being able to select text and then right-click on it, copy to the clipboard, and then paste it somewhere else, controlling the number of prints that would be allowed of the PDF, preventing screen grabs, and so forth. So he was looking to see, does anybody out there know anything that could help him out in that regard? And then Karen posted about comedian Matt Wright and his thoughts on the tech industry. And so a little bit of a YouTube video on what this person's thoughts were. And then Alan posted about Arduino, which is a open source hardware platform. And so there was somebody who had a bunch of Arduino technology that they were looking to unload. And so Alan was suggesting that if anybody wanted some Arduino technology, which typically sensors and things like that, they could get in touch with this person and get some free Arduino hardware. So these are the sort of things that come up on the user forum. So how does a member forum work? And so if anybody is familiar with older technology, there used to be a program called List Server, probably still around. And it was the beginning of these discussion group type things. And basically the way it works is that anybody who's subscribed to this particular forum, which in this case is a Google group, the subscribers can post messages in either of two ways. They can either send an email to the email address of the forum, or they can go to the Google Groups website directly and post it right into the forum through a web page. When they post anything, any message they post will get distributed to every forum subscriber via email. So it's a broadcast to everybody who's subscribed. And then the subscribers can actually reply to a posting. And if they reply, the reply will get sent to all of the subscribers as well. And in that means your discussion will grow and people contribute to it and you help fulfill the Ottawa PC Group's motto, which is users helping users. So there are a couple of ways that you can actually join the forum, and I'm going to not cover a couple of the more complex ways of doing it. I'm going to get the instructions on our webpage updated because one of the instructions there on how to do it is actually a little bit more convoluted than it really needs to be. The easiest way to join the forum and use the forum is straight through email. So from the email address where you want all these forum messages to actually go to, a lot of us have multiple email addresses, so go into the email where you want to interact with the member forum. It doesn't have to be the email address that we have on record for you, so it can be any email address that you have under your control. And I will say that if you have a Gmail address, there are certain benefits to actually subscribing using a Gmail address, but any email address will work. So from that email, you send an email to sysop@opcug.ca, or you can send it direct me. Sysop@opcug.ca is an alias to my email address anyway, so it'll still come to me. All you have to do in the email is say that you want to join the member forum, and then you have to give a little bit of information, because I have to verify that you really are a member of the Ottawa PC User Group, because the member forum is restricted to only members. It's one of the few benefits that is only open to members and not guests. So in it, you can give your membership number if you know it, your full name as you provided it for the membership, your postal address as provided for membership, or the email address that you provided for the membership. Anything in there that you know will allow us to validate that you truly are a member, send that off, and you will get membership will be verified. and then your email address that you sent that email from will get added as a subscriber to the forum, and you will receive a welcome message when you get subscribed. So, again, the easiest way of doing things with the forum is interacting through email, both subscribing as well as using the forum. So from the subscribed email address, again, it's only from that address that you'll be able to interact with the forum, send a message to opcug-member-forum@googlegroups.com. When you do that, your message will be distributed to all of the subscribers to the forum, including yourself. Emails distributed through the forum will have at the start of the subject line, in square brackets, OPCUG-member-forum on the subject line. And so the reason why we do this is so that it allows it to easily identify emails that come from the forum as different from other emails that arrive in your mailbox. So a benefit of that is that you can do things like create rules. So, for example, you could have all of the email that comes from the forum will go into a folder. Or you could have, like, if I wanted, for some example, anything that Alan is posting to the forum, I want it to remain in my inbox, you know, where I'll get access to it or I'll see it more readily or something like that. So you can create all these rules. Most email packages will allow you to create rules that will identify those emails and treat them in some special manner. So replies to messages that are distributed from the forum, you can reply to messages that were distributed from the forum, and that helps to contribute to the discussion. So if you just want to get that back and forth contribution going on. Now, replies usually will go to the forum rather than the sender. But it is somewhat dependent on the email package that you actually use. There is a tag within the email that is a reply to, and your email package should honor that and have the reply go back to the forum, opcug-member-forum@googlegroups.com. However, there's a chance that your mail program will actually just send the reply to the sender as opposed to going back to the group. So what I would suggest you do is make sure, especially at the start of using it, verify what the to is going to go to. So if you do a reply, look at the to line on the email and make sure you know where it's actually going to. You may have to do a reply all or reply to group or something like that in order to have it go back to the forum. As I said, check it out. You don't want to accidentally think that you're sending a reply in particular to the individual and then have it go back to all of the forum subscribers and you don't realize what's going on. So take a little bit of care with that. You can also use the forum through the web, and this takes a little bit of extra things to set up, but it can be really handy. So there are a couple of benefits to accessing the forum through the web as opposed to just interacting through email. One of them is that you can access older messages. So there's over 5,300 threads in the forum now. We never expire anything out of there. And so you can go back and look at old conversations. There being a Google group, belonging to Google, you would expect search capabilities to be good. And so basically the capabilities you come to expect from searching Google for the web, you can search the forum for old messages. And it gives you the ability to access the forum even if you can't get to your email address. So there is a little bit more to configure it rather than just using email. So the reason for that is in order for you to be able to access the forum through the web, you have to be authenticated because we don't just allow just anybody to post to the forum. They have to be already a member of the forum. The only way that Google has to authenticate you is if it is a Google account. So this is where if you happen to subscribe using a Gmail address, it takes out one of the steps here because Gmail accounts are automatically a Google account. All other email addresses can be made into a Google account, but they won't be there by default. So you'd have to add that, create a Google account in the name of your email address if it is not a Gmail account. So let's look at if you're subscribed to the forum using a non-Gmail email address. So samspade@example.net, something like that. So you have to make your email address a Google account. So the way you do it is you browse to accounts.google.com. And if you don't see this box in the middle of the screen, you'll see in the top right-hand corner there'll be a profile icon or picture. And click on that and sign out, because if you don't see this sign in dialog box, it means you're already signed into the browser using some form of authentication. So what you want to get to is where you see this sign in screen. Click the create account. And then you'll get prompted for a bunch of things, your first name, last name, and some other information. And then you will get to a screen where it says choose your Gmail address. And it gives you an example of a couple of Gmail addresses that you can have available to you based on what you put in for your first name and last name. I chose Sam Spade, so it came up with SS and some numbers, or spade9258@gmail.com, or the ability to create your own Gmail address where you can select your own prefix for the username portion of the email address. You don't want any of that. What you want is to click use your existing email, because you're trying to turn your existing email address into a Google account. So then you put in your email address you use to subscribe to the forum. So in this case here, I have an example. I subscribe to the forum using the email address of sam.spade@example.com. So I put that in, click on the next, follow the prompts, and they're fairly straightforward, but you go through. And at the end of that, your email address will then be a Google account. And so you can then use that to access the forum. So you now have a Google account and you're subscribed to the OPCUG-member-forum using an email address that is a Google account. It is either going to be a Gmail address, which was already a Google account, or you've got that non-Gmail email address, which you just turned into a Google account. So now Google Groups can authenticate who you are. So, and you can be given access, and Google Groups can actually allow you access to the member forum in a web browser. So easy access to Google Groups at that point is, this is an example, if you're subscribed using a Gmail address. So say I'm just in Gmail on the web. All I have to do is click on the waffle icon and then choose Groups. If you don't see groups in the list, you will see more apps or something like that at the bottom, and you can click on that, and groups will be in the list at that point. So you just click on groups, and then you may get The other way of accessing is just going directly to Google Groups in your web browser. So you just browse to groups.google.com, and if you're prompted to sign in using the email address you used to subscribe to the forum, which, of course, is now a Google account. So then you will get a list of the groups that you have access to under that particular authentication. So OPCUG member forum should be listed at that point, and all you have to do is click on the line where it says OPCUG member forum at googlegroups.com to access the forum. If you don't see OPCUG-member-forum when you go to groups.google.com and you get this where you're not a member of any groups yet, take a look at the top right-hand corner where it has the icon for the account and click on it. And in this case, I see, hi, Cheryl, and I'm logged in already in the browser using a different account. And so what I would do then is just click on sign out. You will then get signed out, and you can sign in. Let me just jump back to there. You will get this where you get that sign in using that account, and then you will get to the point where you'll actually see the forum listed under My Groups. You can click on it, and you will get into the forum where you actually see the messages. And if you wanted to create a brand new conversation that is going to go out to everybody else who's a member of the forum, you just click on New Conversation in the top left corner. The existing conversations are listed. You can click on any line to read that particular thread of messages. And you can see there's an actual count of the messages in each of the threads. So the top one has 7 messages in the thread, the second one has 3 messages in the thread, and so forth. When you click on the title line of one of them, it will bring up that entire message, and you'll find that the most recent message in the conversation is at the bottom. So it is chronological with most recent at the bottom. And only part of the thread will actually be expanded to show the full text. The other messages in the thread are collapsed, and you can click on any one of those lines to expand that particular message in that thread of messages. Or you can click on the little up and down chevrons to expand all of the messages in the thread so you can see them all in one go. If you want to reply to it, you can reply all. And there will be individual, if you expand out each individual section, you can actually reply to the thread as a whole down at the bottom, or you can be replying to a particular person's message within the thread. If you expand out, you can see there above the click reply all to contribute to the conversation, that little reply all icon would be replying more directly to that particular message in the thread. So if you have any questions or problems, by all means, email sysop@opcug or my email address. And if there are any other questions, I'd be happy to entertain them now and take you through any scenarios.
Hi, Chris. I'm looking at my Google Drive, and I don't see groups. And I don't – what is it? You said to click on more apps, but I don't see that on my computer.
So you went to the Waffle
– I went to the Google Drive. Yeah, the nine dots.
Yeah. So if you scroll down, if you don't see Google Groups in there, scroll to the bottom. You should see an icon or a listing or something near the bottom or something that says more apps or something like that.
It says more from Google, but it took
me more from Google. Yeah, that'd be that's right. More from Google.
But it took me to I don't know how to. It doesn't. Okay. I see where it is now.
Yeah, and then if you choose Google Groups there, and I think it'll automatically add it to the waffle icon, so that in the future, if you just click on the waffle icon, I think Google Groups will then be listed.
Okay. I'm actually not seeing group. Oh, there it is. Yep. Okay. Got it. All right. Thank you. Yep. Got it.
Do we have any other questions, Alan? Alan, you're not able to talk. I guess I'll have to look through to see if we don't have a lot in here. So,
actually, there is one from Bob Harris. He says that when he posts something in the forum, it doesn't get emailed back to him sometimes.
Bob, are you using Gmail? Yes, you are. You're using Gmail.
That's Gmail, yes.
Yeah, Gmail is weird. Gmail, it actually, when it comes back to you, when it's Gmail, this is the only mail system I know of that actually acts this way. It thinks, it knows that you sent the email. And so it says, I already have a record of this in the sent items, and so I'm not going to clutter up your inbox with your own email. So it's the only email system I know that'll do that. Every other email system I know, it'll actually echo it back to you. But Gmail, in their infinite wisdom, the way that they handle mail, they don't do that. And in a sense, It makes sense if you understand how Google Mail, Gmail operates. Gmail has no concept really of folders of any description at all. All your emails are in one big bucket, and they use tags to decide where they're actually going to display these messages. Are they going to display it in, you know, your inbox, your sent items, or what looks like a folder on the left-hand panel in Gmail? Those aren't actually folders. They're just tags. So you have one big, huge bucket. All your emails are in there, and they use tags to decide where it's going to display. And so Google has just decided that, yeah, you sent this message, so you don't need another copy of it in your Gmail mailbox, and they just don't display it. Very, very strange, but that's Google for you. And I see who's Michelin posts all the great stuff on Google Groups. Michelin is with us tonight, so Michelin Johnson. And so she is a prolific poster to our Google group. Yeah, Stuart says you can just type Google Groups in the address bar of a browser. That's right. Basically, it just takes you to groups.google.com. Is there a way to override that setting in Gmail so that you can get a copy sent back? Not that I'm aware of. I don't know any way of actually fooling Gmail into displaying it. You just have to trust that when you send your email from Gmail, that it actually gets sent there. Okay, I think that's all of the questions in the chat now. We can come back to that later on if people have additional questions about it. I would really encourage people to sign up for the forum if you're not already signed up. We don't have anywhere near all of the members signed up, so there's a lot of members who are not subscribed to the forum. And again, if you have any problem, just email me, and I'd be happy to help you out with that. Okay, the next share is a follow-up, or yeah, it's a continuation, I guess, of disk partitioning from Alan. So he has here a picture of his drive C, the blue, and he also has two other partitions on this particular physical disk, a boot partition and a recovery partition, and that's probably the minimum that people will see typically on their own computers. So he poses the question, why do you want to add a partition? And so he likes to have a dedicated data drive or partition. And so he likes to keep his data separated from the programs and the operating system themselves. So he finds it easier to do a backup. If he religiously backs up the entire data partition, he's sure that he's getting all of the information that he needs, that he created, that nobody else has a copy of. You can get away with this sort of thing if you, and I still encourage people to do image backups to be able to do easier recovery, but maybe you don't need to be backing it up quite as frequently, your entire Windows partition with the applications, but you do want to back up the data on an ongoing basis. You can do incremental disk imaging where it'll only back up changes since the last backup was run. And you can do things like file and folder synchronization where you just selectively do portions of the data partition to back them up separately. So the question is, how do you create a new partition? So Alan has here a picture of disk management, and he's put in yellow things that we're going to ignore right now. And those are all on physical disk 0, and he's highlighted disk 1, and it has a couple of partitions on it. And if you look at the lower portion of it, you have that 100 megabyte EFI system partition. Then he has a drive E, which is basically a 1 terabyte partition, which is BitLocker encrypted. And then he has 1 gigabyte. Recovery partition. Now, I presume that this was actually a disk that was taken out of another computer. That's actually a regular Windows drive where you see drive E is what I'm presuming it really is. But regardless, he has a disk there with a number of partitions on it. He wants to create an additional partition on it specifically for data. So the way to get to it is you right-click on the Start button, And in the pop-up menu, you choose Disk Management. And then you get to that screen. Now, what he's going to try to do is shrink down that drive E, because basically the entire drive is used up. And so he wants to make space for another partition. So if you right-click on it, and you choose, or you go to the action menu, you can do it through a right-click or through the action menu, and choose Shrink Volume. And you can see the hash marks on that. And that's one handy thing with disk management. Whatever disk partition you're actually acting on is shown with those crosshatches, so you know what it is that's being affected. So he right-clicks, or chooses on the action menu, Shrink Volume, and then it'll go away for a couple of seconds, and it'll come back with the dialog box where you actually choose to shrink it. So it tells you the total size in megabytes before you shrink it, and then the size of the available shrink space in megabytes. So this is the amount that you could actually shrink it down, leaving the existing data on the partition. So you then enter in the size that you actually want to shrink it down, and then it tells you what the remaining size is going to be. You click on shrink, and then it comes back. And in this case, he has allocated 100 gigabytes, basically, to this new partition. So the E drive has been shrunk down by 100 gigabytes. And he has this, what is known as unallocated space. So it's space that's available on that physical drive, and nothing has been done with it yet. So then what you have to do is decide what you're going to do with it. So if you go to the action menu under all tasks, you can create a new simple volume. So this will create that partition so that the operating system can actually use it. Comes up with a wizard. You click on next. And then it'll ask you to specify the size you want for the volume. By default, it will use 100% of the space that's available, but you could actually create a new volume in that space, leaving some unallocated space that you could partition to, for another purpose if you wanted. But he's going to use this entire 100 gigabytes, into one partition. Then it asks you to decide if you want to assign a drive letter to it. And so you can click on the down caret and choose a different drive letter if you want, other than what's provided to you. What's provided to you will be the next available drive letter. But if you want to, you can choose any available letter. And then it'll ask you to format the partition. And it'll suggest the file system. And depending on what it is you're partitioning, you may get a different file system suggested. In most cases, you're going to end up with NTFS and the default allocation size and the new volume label. It gives you a suggested name for it. You can actually name it anything you want, so it'll show up in File Explorer with that name as opposed to new volume. So in this case, Alan has typed in data partition. Now, one thing that Alan didn't highlight on this slide that is really, really important is the next thing down on the slide, perform a quick format. It will be checked by default. Don't uncheck that. If you uncheck that and you are operating on a drive that is, say, you know, 4 terabytes, you can be certain that it's going to take several hours to actually format the drive. Leave it with it checked for perform a quick format, and you will be done in a couple of seconds as opposed to a couple of hours. Click on the next, and then it'll come up with the end of the wizard, and it'll say what it's going to do, and then you click on finish, and it will go ahead and do that. And it does take just a couple of seconds. I see a question in... Enable file and folder compression. What about compression? I've never actually used compression at the volume level. I suppose you could. The amount of compression you get on NTFS typically isn't really huge. There is a little bit of overhead that is required to actually do compression. But I guess if you wanted to compress all files that are on that particular partition, you could do that. Okay, and then we have, it'll pop back into Disk Management and it'll show you the partition that got created, and it has been assigned the drive letter X, and it is just shy of the 100 gigabytes. So if you go back out to File Explorer, you can now see the disk partition X is there. It has been named data partition, so whatever name you gave it, so you can more easily identify what this is actually going to be used for. And then if you actually go to that, you'll see this folder is empty because it's a brand new partition. There's no information that's been added to it yet. So, and then with that, so coming up, Alan is going to continue his series with talking about data backup. So doing disk imaging using incremental backup, using a file and folder synchronization program to selectively backup portions of what's on that volume, and real-time backup, which is a way of making sure that as files are created and modified, they are automatically backed up in real time. So that'll be coming. I see Ed said, last time I checked, quick format only does an overwrite of some critical blocks. What happens if this is first use, i.e. unformatted partition? That's fine. It'll do whatever it has to do in the background as it uses the drive. The one thing it will not do is actually do any surface checking on the drive. Drives nowadays are so reliable that I'm not overly concerned about the idea that there may be some surface problems, and NTFS in particular has pretty elegant ways of dealing with that anyways. So I don't think there is any benefit really to saying not do a quick format on it. Okay, we'll continue on. So we have Carol Pearson, who just sent this in this evening. And so if she has any further information, she can pop in and clarify. But she sent in an email saying that she, and again, this was sent to suggestion box at opcug.ca. So that's another way that you can get stuff onto the agenda for Q&A evenings. So she sent in an email saying that she found some old Christmas letters in WPS. She later clarified that she thinks it's Microsoft Works was the program that actually created the files. She can't open them. Google said Word should be able to open them. And she's asking, is there any way to convert them to a Word doc or some other format? So I'm presuming, Carol, that you actually did try to just do a file open and point to the file and try to open it that way?
I tried to open it. Then it comes up with that box, choose which program you want to open. I tried Word. I tried.
Oh. Try going into Word and then do a file open and point to the document.
I don't know what you mean.
Well, you did it by double-clicking the file in File Explorer, right?
I went to my file, yes, and I clicked on it, and then it said, what do you want to open it? So,
yeah.
But so, it's not in Word, so how do I?
No. Go into Microsoft Word, and then you click on the File menu.
Okay.
And then choose open and point to the file.
Okay, you're going way faster than me.
Let me actually do another. I'm going to stop this share.
Okay.
And I'm going to share. I'm going to open up Word. And you'll be able to follow along with that. So I'm going to, okay. So let me just share this. Whoops. Okay. Let me that over. Share screen and Word share. So if you open up Microsoft Word, it should look something like this, right?
Where am I going?
You seeing? Yep.
Yep.
Okay. So then you would just click on open. And then you would browse and then find your file.
Okay, let me try. I was just trying that.
Now, if it's a Works file, I would be willing to bet this will work.
Okay.
Because it's a Microsoft format, I can't imagine they wouldn't have a converter built into Microsoft Word that would handle works files.
Okay.
Does it work?
I gotta find the file.
Okay. Okay, you carry on with that. What I'm going to do is I'm going to stop the share because
Okay.
if it doesn't work, there is another option.
Okay.
So, but you continue on with that.
Okay.
Okay, so we're back to the deck here. And I would suggest the next best thing would be try an online converter. And there are several of them out there. In the couple of minutes I had before Q&A tonight, I found these two, online-convert.com and convertio.co. And both of them claim to be able to handle hundreds of different file formats and convert them into a couple of standard formats like Microsoft Word or PDF or some things like that. And it can be done for free. And some of them have some limits placed on it that you can only do two a day or things like that. You can pay money to get unlimited number of conversions and things like that. But there's a whole bunch of sites like this that will give you at least limited ability to open up different file formats that are now defunct and you don't have the native application that created them, and you can convert to one of the standard formats that are available nowadays. If anybody else has any other ideas on things that you can do, chime in if you have your favorite converter while we wait and see if that worked for Carol.
Under pressure, I can't even find the file. So sorry, I'll just keep looking. You can carry on.
Okay, I'm pretty sure that it'll work. Tom mentioned that filehippo.com download Microsoft Word. Oh, there's actually a Microsoft Works file converter that you can get from FileHippo. So Tom's pasted that into the chat. So if that didn't work, you could actually try that one.
Okay.
And he says Abbey Word, LibreOffice, and OpenOffice can also possibly open the files.
Okay.
Bob Gowan had another one, pdf.wps.com, blog, How to Open WPS File Easiest Ways in 2022, post 886. So there are a number of options if Word refuses to understand the file.
Okay, I'll click on those and save them and search for them.
Oh, Harvey, that was the actual conversion site that I think you mentioned that before, Harvey, Zamzar, and it handles several thousand file formats. And I was trying to remember that one before the Q&A so I could place it into the document. So yeah, Zamzar.com is another site that allows you to do a huge, huge number of file formats and convert them between different formats. And that is the one that I believe limits you to two a day or something like that, unless you pay money. Timothy says it may be a very old WordPerfect that more modern Office programs may not be able to open. Again, any of those online converters should be able to handle WordPerfect format files without any difficulty.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Okay, we'll carry on then, and hopefully, Carol, you can report back if you have had success with that before the end of Q&A.
Okay.
So we are into the final 10, and so if there are any other questions, comments, or shares, by all means, throw them into the chat or unmute yourself, and we'll take things as they come. While we're waiting for the flood of additional information to come in, I'll remind you that the next Q&A is going to be January 31st, next Wednesday night, and send in your questions, answers, topics, shares, anything you want to have into suggestion box at opcug.ca. They get handled in the order received, so the earlier you get them in, the more likely they are to make it onto the agenda. Right now, we have very little that's on the agenda, so Elizabeth has a question about Microsoft Office. Go ahead.
Right now, the laptop I'm using is running Office 2007, and that's all I need, and I'm very happy with it. But I decided the other day to get myself a new small laptop so that I can move all my banking and my taxes and all the rest of it onto this other laptop, but nothing else on it, and do no web surfing and fun and games as I do on this laptop here. So anyway, the new laptop comes with nothing except Windows 11. So I would really like to have 2007 on my new laptop. Now I'm just wondering what my options are. I've been looking around, and I can buy it for, I can buy, like, for example, Office 2021 or 2019 for about $170 plus tax. But then you see everywhere on the internet now, they've got other people who are selling the licenses or something for less than that. And, but I don't trust it because, you know, I don't want to buy something from somebody then having the key reversed or rescinded or something 2 months down the road. So is it possible to copy from my current laptop, 2007, onto my new laptop? Is that possible? How could I do it? Or is this illegal and I shouldn't be saying it?
Well, yeah, you shouldn't be saying it, but having said that, there's no easy, do you have the original installation media?
I do. Yeah, I do. And I have the key and all that, but I don't think they allow you to anymore. They allow with 2007. I don't think they allow you to reuse it.
I'm using Word 2007.
Yeah.
It still works. You can load it on from your CD.
Yeah, it should work, and it should be activatable through Microsoft Activation Servers. So I don't think you can buy it now, but you can certainly do an install and activate it. Now, in activation, I will say that you are probably have a license that is good for one PC. The automation the activation process for Microsoft products is totally automated. And in my experience, they will allow you at least two activations before they decide that, oh, this must be pirated, and therefore you can't use this license key. And if you do get to the point where it says, no, this license is already in use, if you persist through the process online, you can actually get to a point where you can appeal this to higher powers that be at Microsoft. And what I would suggest is you just persist through as much as you have to, if you need to actually even talk to a person and just say, well, your piece of crap Windows blew up on me and I had to reinstall it, and that's why I need this second activation. And say, you know, my other computer just doesn't exist anymore, and they'll go ahead and activate it. The only license keys that they will refuse to activate is if they see it's been activated like 20 times. You know, but if it's reasonable that, you know, yes, you own this, you're activating it again for a legitimate reason, your computer blew up, and they'll go ahead and they will activate it. But you will probably find that it'll activate fine by itself automatically through the automated process. Like I say, I think they will allow at least two activations on any license key.
Okay, so that's good. I'm going to try that. My first challenge, though, is that it's on the medium is on a CD,
yep.
And my new little laptop thing doesn't have a CD drive.
Okay, what I would do is just go to you have a desktop computer that has a CD drive?
I have another laptop that's much older that has a CD drive. I never got rid of it because it has a CD drive.
So what I would just do is copy the contents of the CD onto a flash drive.
Okay.
And then use the flash drive on your new computer.
Okay.
Now, there are other options as well. You know, Tom talked about shareware on sale in the forum, and they have probably weekly that they have copies of Microsoft Office, older versions like 2010 or 2013 or something like that, for 87% off. And those are legitimate licenses. And so we have a number of people in the user group who have gone through trusted sources like Shareware on Sale and had no problem activating the license key that they got through Shareware on Site. And there's a couple of other places that have these deals on periodically with like 87% off. So if you did want a more recent version of Microsoft Office, you could go that route. The other thing, Alan just posted LibreOffice, free and open source, supports Office files. There's a number of other packages out there for doing Microsoft Office type applications. LibreOffice, by far the best known and best supported. So there'd be that'd be another option for you to go if you wanted.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind going up to like 2019, and I've seen those packages for 80% off.
Yeah,
but I was afraid of them. So if people on this call have already bought it and it's working, then I'll go ahead.
What I would suggest is that you, if you're not on the member forum, get signed up for the member forum. And then the next time you get one of these emails offering it at 80% off or 87% off or whatever it is, post the information to the member forum and just say, is this a legitimate offer or not? And some people probably can validate and say, yeah, they're really a trustworthy source. Or, you know, you might get back silence, in which case, you know, there is a little bit of a danger because there are people who are selling illegal license keys, but there are a lot of people that are selling legitimate copies, typically just one or two versions old.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, Tom just pasted in Office 19 at $40 U.S. Yeah, so that's a pretty good deal for Microsoft Office. So, yeah, so that is, and softwarekeep.ca. So Timothy posted about that. And Office 2013 Professional for $158. I bet that's U.S. But, yeah, certainly a lot cheaper than the going down to Best Buy or trying to buy it at Microsoft.com.
That's
Canadian.
Way.
Oh, Canadian. Okay.
It's Canadian.
The simplest and cheapest way is to just use your Windows 2007 CD and load it on from there. That's what I did, and I'm running 2007 and Windows 11, and it works fine. So
yeah, it should work perfectly well. And then you have familiarity between your multiple computers, right? It's the same package, so a lot easier to use it if you don't have to have different menus and things like that.
The only thing I would do with 2007 is that the help program wants to go off to the internet and for Windows Word at least, and then it says, "Oh, there's nothing here. I don't have any help for you." But if you can turn off the internet access using Windows Firewall Control or I forget what it's called. It's, what is it?
You're muted, Tom.
Or use a Windows Firewall Control or GlassWire and turn off the access for Windows Word or any of the Office programs to access the internet. I find it both unsafe and also the help doesn't work. So I would turn off the internet access for Microsoft Word if you know a way.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Okay, just while we wait and see if there anything else is coming up, just a reminder that the February meeting, Tom is going to be presenting on using ChatGPT to program in Python. So I'm looking forward to see what that amounts to. So he managed to get ChatGPT creating a Python program that will combine chat and caption transcripts from Q&A, I presume, together by time. So we'll look forward to that. Reminder that the Ottawa Public Library presentations that we give are ongoing here, and so there's a whole bunch that are coming up. If you now go to, we changed the location on our website for them, so if you just click on the events in the top bar on our website, it will list all of the events, including the Ottawa PC User Group presentations, as well as so our monthly meetings, our Q&As, as well as the library presentations. Reminder that you should register for any of the programs that are at the Ottawa Public Library, not because we take attendance, but because if nobody's registered, the presenter will not be there. So good idea to register at the Ottawa Public Library for an event that you want to attend. And with that, we are at 8:30:36, and I think we are done for the evening.
I was striking out. I'll find them and try it. So.
Oh, right. You haven't found it? Okay. So you just haven't found your documents, huh?
Right. It's I did find them, but not through the Word program. So
okay.
They're from 2000, 2001.
Okay. Let me know if it works or not. And
I will.
We can continue it on next week if you're still having difficulties.
All right. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. Thanks, everybody, for showing up. And thanks, Alan, for passing on. I hope I didn't butcher your slides too much. And we'll see you all next week.